Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Pat Dorsey, and he'll be answering your most important questions on fly fishing tailwaters. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we are broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Pat a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill in your name and email address in the form on our homepage, and we'll keep you informed. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website within 24 hours after the show ends. So if you do have to leave early, you can return to our website at your convenience and listen to the broadcast at any time. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. Recordings or transcriptions of this program cannot be distributed or sold in any form. When we return, we'll be talking with Pat Dorsey about fly fishing tailwaters. Our approach is simple, education. Fly Fusion is unique when it comes to fly fishing magazines. It is one of only a few magazines in North America that focuses on instruction and education. In Fly Fusion, we've covered subjects like short line nymphing, tactics for tough days, stillwater fly patterns, dry fly fishing for fussy trout, and a host of other interesting and educational topics. Visit our website today at www.flyfusionmag.com. That's www.flyfusionmag.com. And start your subscription to Fly Fusion today so that you can learn all you need to know about fly fishing. Before we introduce Pat, we'd like to let you know about the great gifts we have to give away tonight. On our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers and a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. So you have 2 chances to win tonight in our drawing. Now, if you haven't registered yet for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage, which is at askaboutflyfishing.com, and look for the link under Pat's section that says click here to register for our drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. And thanks to Pat Dorsey and Stackpole Books, we'll also be giving away a copy of Pat's latest book, Fly Fishing Tailwaters. What else? And how appropriate, right? Here's how you can win. You've got to be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. And the question will be about something we talked about during the show. You've got to submit your answer along with your name and your location in that text box on our homepage. So the same place that you're submitting questions during the show, that's where you'll submit your answer at the end of the show. So listen closely, use your best typing skills, and hopefully you'll win Pat's book. When it comes to fly fishing challenging waters, Pat Dorsey's credentials are impeccable. He is the guide director and partner of the Blue Quill Angler in Evergreen, Colorado, a full-service fly shop which was selected Orvis National Outfitter of the Year in 2000, and again in 2002. Pat himself was selected Orvis National Guide of the Year in 2001. He spends over 200 days a year on the water, and his book, Fly Fishing Guide to the South Platte River, is a highly regarded standard. In addition to selecting and training the guides for Blue Quill, he has published articles in Fly Fisherman magazine, and he's a highly sought speaker at fly fishing venues around the country. He is active in TU and cold water conservation efforts, and he still finds time to tie flies. A master tier and innovator, Pat still does a good bit of fly tying, tying demos, and is a contract tier for Umpqua Feather Merchants. Having fished, taught, and guided on Colorado's gold medal streams for 14 years, Pat's philosophy can be paraphrased as, fly fishing is a problem-solving exercise, absolutely, not a matter of luck. And he's also quoted as saying, if you can catch fish on the South Platte, you can catch fish anywhere. Well, Pat, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing. In fact, the last time we were talking about the South Platte.
Yes, sir. Hey, Roger. Thank you for having me on this evening.
Well, great. Good to have you. Good to have you. Last time we were talking about the South Platte and the difficulty of those waters, and there's some tailwaters up on the South Platte that that you fish quite regularly, don't you?
Yeah, in fact, I did a guide trip in Cheeseman today, and it's kind of my home waters, and I've always felt like if you could catch fish on the South Platte, you could probably catch fish on just about any river, whether it's an eastern tailwater or a western tailwater. So, you know, that's the beauty of a tailwater. A tailwater's a tailwater, and certainly a guy should be able to master any tailwater with a basic set of tactics and a basic set of flies.
Good, good. Well, we got a lot to dig into tonight because our audience has submitted a ton of questions for you. So it's a hot topic, that's for sure. Well, let's dig right in. First of all, let's talk about what constitutes a tailwater. What is a tailwater? And so if you could maybe kind of lay that out for us?
That's a great question. I think there's a lot of people that, whether they're new or old to the sport of fly fishing, they probably may or may not understand a tailwater, and especially its paradoxical nature of the role of the reservoir and the role of the dam. And if it were not for a huge piece of concrete tucked between two towering canyon walls, the fishery that you and I have come to know would probably not exist. So basically, a tailwater refers to a fishery that flows beneath a man-made impoundment or a dam. And unlike an unregulated river, it's a managed fishery. So it certainly creates, you know, a world-class fishery in almost every scenario.
So we've got water below a dam. What makes it so special?
Well, there's a lot of different release mechanisms, and hopefully we can discuss those later in the show. But, you know, you have a controlled fishery, so it's fishable 365 days a year. And when you make a comparison, generally I like to make a comparison to an unregulated river or a river that freestone that's not dammed. So obviously you have clear, cold releases from the bottom of the dam. That makes a tailwater very ideal. It's fishable 365 days a year. That makes it very ideal. Generally, you have huge populations of trout. Stable water temperatures is another condition that makes fishing so well. And you have nutrient-rich waters that are released from the reservoir above, creating a very stable and very healthy environment.
Now, how long, you know, when we've got the dam there, how far down the river would you refer to the river as a tailwater?
I think
point it goes back to its normal kind of thing?
It does. I mean, certainly, you know, the further that you get away from the dam, then the more unstable it becomes, because you have tributaries that enter the river that change the clarity. The water warms as it gets further away. So the further you progress from the dam, the more it starts to resemble freestone and unregulated river. But, you know, in the winter months, generally on your smaller tailwaters, you'll have open water for the first 4 miles. On some of your larger tailwaters, like the Bighorn, you know, you've got it open for several miles. So it really is based on the volume of water, the depth of the reservoir, and a lot of other factors that could really be factored in there. But the fact is, I think most of your tailwater characteristics, you know, 5-6 miles is what I would consider a true tailwater, maybe up to 8 miles. But certainly the further that you get away from the dam, the more it starts to resemble an unregulated river, as I mentioned.
Yeah, and it seems to me in most of the tailwaters I've been on, too, it's, you know, when you're up near the dam, you tend to find more rainbows, and as it warms up and moves down, then you start getting into the browns. Is that pretty common in most tailwaters?
It is. You know, a lot of tailwaters you find considerably larger brown populations further from the dam, and that's predominantly because of the water temperatures. And browns and rainbows, you know, the longer that you fish, the more that you understand that they're really two different animals. They feed differently. They prefer different types of structure, and, you know, browns are considerably tougher to catch than rainbows, but once you learn the nuances of each species, then they become a little bit easier to catch. But you're exactly right. I mean, you look at tailwaters like the San Juan, you have a fairly dense population of rainbows and not as many browns, although the brown population over the years has it has gotten bigger. But in general, that's a correct assessment.
Okay. I mean, you mentioned fishing tailwaters 12 months out of the year. Are there, you know, seasonal effects that affect the fishing there, or does it fish basically the same for 12 months out of the year?
It is a fairly controlled environment, but certainly there is seasons. And, you know, I really think, you know, your winter fishing on the tailwater, it can be very challenging from time to time. But, you know, it's generally from November to March. So that's probably the most technical fishing, because you have, you know, cold water temperatures. And that could be anywhere from the mid-30s, the low-40s on a typical bottom-release tailwater. And so that'll be challenging. It's mostly midges and teeny flies, you know, down to a size 26. But then as you get into the spring months, you know, and the fish in the winter months, they stack up in the deeper pools to conserve energy. And then you start to get into the spring, you start to see the water temperatures, you know, rise up into the 42, 44 degree range, and that stimulates the betas mayflies to hatch, and the fish start to spread out into the riffles again. And And then as you get into the midsummer, depending upon the release mechanism of the reservoir, you could have, you know, water temperatures still in the low 40s, but you could, if you had like Flaming Gorge where you have mixing towers, you could have, you know, water temperatures in the mid 50s. If you get a reservoir that's got part of the water spilling over the surface, then you have warmer water. So you have your summer temperatures, ideal growth rates, and more activity from the fish. And then certainly as the autumn months start to come in, you have, you know, kind of a reverse role there. Water temperature starts to cool down, and we get in back into the autumn months. So there's definitely seasons to a tailwater, strategies that will make you effective as an angler to a tailwater, and certainly, yeah, it's important to pay attention to all those nuances.
Well, we've got several questions here about water flow. And David in Leawood, Kansas says, when there is a release and the water is beginning to rise, I found that is one of the best times to be in the water fishing. Do you change your methods or types of flies at this time? And do you find that fishing is better when water's on the rise?
That's a tricky question to answer because it depends upon the tailwater that you're fishing. In most cases, as a whole, when the flow changes, fishing usually deteriorates. Now, that's not always the case. Some hydroelectric fisheries, for example, Lee's Ferry, that's when the best fishing is when the flow is coming up and it's dislodging a lot of those scuds and other food organisms, and that's when the fishing is good. So it depends, but, you know, small releases on bottom release tailwaters, water storage tailwaters, let's say anywhere from 30 to 50 CFS, they have a minimal effect on it. In fact, sometimes they'll kick midge larvae loose, and it can actually create a small feeding frenzy. I have seen that before, but I think as a whole, I would rather have a decrease in flow as opposed to a rise in flow. It's pretty tough.
Okay, another question from Bob in Jefferson City, Missouri. He says, what conditions do you find the best overall catching for trophy catches? High water, low water? Does it make a difference?
I think probably the best time to catch a trophy trout was during lower water because you can sight nymph and you can see those fish in higher flows, and, of course, they're spread out more and they have a lot more places to hide. So I think, you know, a lot of the bigger fish are caught during lower flows.
And we have another one from Bob in Jefferson City, Missouri. He says, I fish several tailwaters on the White River in Arkansas and Missouri. I struggle with adjusting to the water level changes, either rising or falling. The fish just seem to shut down. How should I adjust to these changes in flow? What are the fish doing?
It's a great question.
What you were just talking about, kind of.
Yeah, fishing is tough when the flow comes. And the hardest thing is not to, you know, have a built-in excuse and just say, okay, I'm not going to catch any fish. You really do have to change your tactics. So, you know, a lot of times, depending upon the volume or the, you know, how drastic the change can be, you know, sometimes fishing bigger flies, bright-colored flies, possibly a pink San Juan worm or a chartreuse egg pattern. But I really found out over the last few years is fishing leech patterns. We fish a chamois leech or a pine squirrel leech, and that really seems to fish effectively during a flow rise. So possibly a crane fly or stone fly or something they can see, and then dropping it off with a, you know, a flashy mayfly nymph or a midge nymph of some sort that they can see during that the water, and then, you know, fish the edges and fish some of the areas that, you know, don't have quite as much flow.
Okay. And for for Bob, we did a show with Davey Wanton on the White River, and he talks a lot about the flows on that tailwater. So, Bob, you might want to listen in our archive to that show. Pat, you had mentioned, you know, Lee's Ferry, Colorado River down there, and we got a question in from Mick in Brookfield, Wisconsin, and you want to know the best time of the year. I suggest, Mick, you listen to our show with Wendy Gunn, and she talks about fishing a whole show on Lee's Ferry, so you might want to catch that. But so I just want to throw those in there because we do have specific shows on those. Okay, and I don't know that you can answer these or not, but we'll give it a shot here. John in San Mateo, California says, when a fish screen is installed in the upstream side of a powerhouse, what is the fish mortality rate? I don't know if that's something that you have in your back pocket there, Pat, or not.
Yeah, I think that would be a great question to, you know, ask your wildlife agency, you know, get hold of the Division of Wildlife or something like that, and they would probably be able to answer that question a lot better than I could. I'm sorry I couldn't be more of assistance on that one.
No problem. And then he also asked about, he knows that different agencies have their regulations, but, you know, do you think there's any reason for or the best guidelines for setbacks when we're talking about fishing close to the dam? Is that more of a security thing than a really fishing thing?
Before 911, I think it was more or less just a lot of the unpredictability of in the undertows and so on and so forth that can take place, you know, around the dam itself. But I think after 911, below the San Juan, you can't get up in there. You know, there's increased awareness around Flaming Gorge Dam, and you know, I think it's a combination of both
safety and security.
Yeah,
safety for you and security for the dam. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, and also, yeah, safety as far as you know, some of these, like again, the White River, I know has pumps out quite a bit of water at one time, and up there on the Green too, in Utah, I've heard a lot of stories of waders getting stranded on the wrong side of the river up there because of the, you know, a strong flow coming out. So I suppose that's part of the factor too. Being too close, you might get hit with a lot of water pretty quickly. Well, let's talk. We do have some questions on equipment here. CJ in Michigan, up in the UP, says he wants to know about, you know, how you're set up. What kind of weight line are you using? Sinking, floating, and how do you set up your leader? Also, Blair Whitting asked about your leaders. Do you hand tie them or do you store-bought? How do you set up for your fishing in the tailwaters?
It generally depends upon the tailwater. On my home waters, Cheeseman Canyon on the South Platte, I tend to fish shorter leaders, 7.5-foot leaders. I do use store-bought leaders. And when I'm fishing bigger rivers, I'll fish, you know, 9 and even 12-foot leaders with additional tippet. It certainly depends upon the time of year, too. Are the fish in the riffles or are they in the transitional zones that funnel down into the deeper holes? So there's a lot of variables there. But I would say, you know, as a whole, I use a 9-foot 5 weight floating line. I very rarely use a sinking line unless I'm fishing streamers or stripping them from my boat. The shorter the better in most cases on the walk wade rivers, and then, as I mentioned, definitely longer leaders for some of the bigger rivers. And, you know, one of the greatest challenges to successful tailwater fishing is trying to find the zone that the fish are feeding in. So that's something. There's a lot of, you know, signs from you. You know, is there midges hatching? Are there betas hatching? Are the fish feeding in the riffles? Is it December and they're back in the frog water and so on and so forth? So that's a tough question. Hopefully I answered part of that for you.
Yeah, you know, basically it depends on the conditions and also what you're fishing, right? Whether you're nymph,
exactly,
dry fly fishing and so forth. Well, this is a little bit more specific. Eric Seal in Avondale, Pennsylvania says, what knots do you like for rigging droppers and tandem rigs? I know everybody has their own little way of doing a, you know, dropper system. What's yours?
I fish a lot of different methods, but most of the fishing I do in walk wade would be conventional short line nymphing, so a strike indicator and two nymphs. I tie my tandem rigs generally with some sort of a flashy attractor based on the time of year. For example, if stoneflies are hatching in June, I use a stonefly nymph as my upper fly. If the caddis are hatching in May, I'd use a caddis of some sort as my attractor. And then I'll drop some sort of a mayfly or a midge. I tie generally about 14 to 16 inches between my weight and my attractor fly, and then 14 to 16 inches between my two flies. And I tie, in a two-fly rig, I tie my flies eye to eye. And there's times when I do use a three-fly rig. And when I do use a three-fly rig, then I space my flies about 8 inches apart, and I drop that off the bend of the hook as opposed to coming out of the eye. So I'd have an attractor fly and then two droppers spaced about 8 inches apart.
Okay, okay. And that kind of answered part of the next question. Gary in Olympic Peninsula, Washington, you know, do you continually change the tippet leader length during fishing? You basically said yes for the water depths. And do you use any weight, split shot or wrap? And you just mentioned you tie your weight up above everything.
I do.
split shot, and do you tie it above the knot where the tippet attaches there?
You know, you're either a split shot guy or you're some sort of a wrap or a putty alternative guy. And I actually use a combination of both. I use a 4 or a 6 split shot right there on the junction between my tippet and my leader. So I'll just put a split on there. And then I micromanage my weight by adding a tungsten putty called Mojo Mud. And it just allows you to fine-tune your weight. And certainly, depending upon the tailwater, you know, in Colorado we tend to do a lot of dredging. But there's tailwaters like the San Juan where they fish a number 4 or 2 number 4s to a lot of fish that are keying on pupa. So you have to be, again, trying to target the fish in the right part of the zone. And you do have to keep your indicator 2 times the depth of the water. And you have to, you know, adjust your weight according to the zone. And it's one thing that you have to do continuously to be successful. So I use a combination of split shot and moldable putty, and I am constantly adjusting my weight.
That moldable putty works nice, doesn't it? Because you can take it off and put it back on without a lot of horsing around, which I really like that stuff. So.
Oh, it's great. It's opened up so many doors. And, you know, so many people have had difficulty with it, putty slipping down their leader. But the problem's solved. Simply just put a split shot above the knot, and then you put your putty over the split shot. And think about, you know, tungsten putty. The sink rate is incredible, and it gets your flies down in the right part of the zone quickly.
Yeah. Well, we need to take a quick break here, Pat, but when we come back, we'll talk with Pat more about fly fishing tailwaters. Front Range Anglers, a full-service fly shop located in Boulder, Colorado, provides premium tackle and comprehensive instruction and guide services to fly fishers across the country. In business for over 25 years and with a staff that averages 20 years of experience, they will give you the straight story on gear, places to fish, flies, and techniques. They publish a monthly newsletter that is one of the most informative and insightful electronic magazines in the industry. Find out more about this premier shop by logging onto their website at www.frontrangeanglers.com. That's www.frontrangeanglers.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pat Dorsey about fly fishing tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Pat a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, Pat, you're a busy man. You just literally walked off the river here today and came to the show, so I know it's going to be a long day for you, but what all are you doing in your fly fishing life? Tell us about your business and your recent projects.
Well, I love to fish, and I love to guide, and I'm going to be, I got 5 guide trips this week, so not a full week, but a pretty good week considering the time of year. And so I try to do as many trips as I can, and then during the off-season, as you mentioned, I wrote a book on the South Platte, and then I just released this tailwater book, and got my fly tying book about done. That'll be out next September, so working on book projects and writing magazine articles and DVDs and just whatever I can to share my passion with other people.
Great, great. Well, and you work out of Blue Quill, right?
Yeah, our shop, Blue Quill Anglers, up in Evergreen. We've been in business for almost 21 years, and we guide the Front Range, all the Colorado, the Williams Fork, the Blue, and, you know, our South Platte. You know, we specialize in teaching fly fishers of all abilities to catch fish.
And why don't you give us, I know we put your website link on your speakers page on our site along with links to your books, but why don't you go ahead and give people the main site there.
Our webpage is bluequillangler.com,
okay.
And we're a full-service fly shop, and we have an online store, so we do a tremendous amount of online sales, and we have a fishing report to try to keep people up to date on conditions and flies and hatches and so on and so forth, and we really just want to be there for you guys. If you have any questions about fly fishing, we want to be there to help you out.
Well, terrific, terrific. Well, you have some friends out there, Pat, that says, "We miss you on the Bighorn. See you this spring, Zoe and Dave." So I guess you know who Zoe and Dave are.
they're great friends of mine, and Dave is actually, he was a big help in my book, in my tailwater book. He's a true authority up there on the Bighorn.
And that's a great tailwater, huh?
It's a great tailwater. That's where I go to play.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite rivers to fish. Okay, we've got some other questions that came in on the Internet. I'm going to try to grab a few of these. Tim in Superior says, what do you think about thingamabobbers, particularly rigging them for right-angle nymphing? You know what thingamabobbers are?
Yeah, the thingamabobber now is the, you know, that's the big rage. And I'm still a yarn guy. I'm not a huge fan of the thingamabobber. I know a lot of our guides are, but I still fish with yarn. Yarn with an orthodontic rubber band like we use is so much easier to adjust. It doesn't foul up your leader. And the thingamabobber, frankly, when it hits the water, it hits the water pretty hard, whereas the yarn hits it fairly soft. So, I mean, there's trade-offs and compromises to any type of indicator rig. And go with what you feel best. Thingamabobbers work great during wind and conditions. And so, you know, again, it's a personal preference. And I understand the importance of the right-angle angling. Again, it's one of those things that you kind of just use your best judgment and what you feel most confident in.
Right. Try it and see if you like it, right? Another question from Larry in Laramie, Wyoming says, what do you see as the biggest mistake fly fishers make? I assume that's, you know, referring to when you're guiding them out there in the tailwater type water.
I think fly fishermen as a whole tend to outthink themselves. You know, it's about choosing the right fly, and it's most importantly is, you know, presenting it so that it looks real to fish. In other words, getting a dead drift in most cases. That's not always the case because sometimes swinging a pattern is effective too. But, you know, it's just keeping things simplified and trying to match the prevailing conditions, keep everything short, good, clean, dead drifts. That's where you're going to catch most of your trout.
Okay. And this kind of backs up to our water level. Warren Davis in Waterville, Ohio asks, when the dams are opened up, how much does the water typically rise in the tailwaters?
It depends. Again, you know, on a hydroelectric tailwater, whether you're fishing the South Holston or Lee's Ferry, you know, it could raise several feet as opposed to traditional, water release like or bottom storage tailwater, water storage tailwater like Cheeseman, where it may come up several inches. So certainly you got to keep your wits about you at all times if you're fishing a hydroelectric tailwater and check the release schedules. That's a good tip. And just, you know, really just pay attention to what's going around. You know, have a marker. By that I mean I usually will put a rock along the edge of the current. Even when I'm guiding in Cheeseman Canyon, I'll put a rock right along the edge of the water. And I keep an eye on that, and then I know whether the river's coming up or going down.
Yeah, it's something definitely to be concerned about. I remember up when I lived in Alaska, guys would be out fishing in the flats. Now, this wasn't the hydroelectric release, but it was the tide. And the tide, they would get stuck in the mud out there, and the tide would come so quickly in that they'd actually drown because they couldn't get out of there quick enough because they weren't paying attention. So I know we don't get those kind of rises, but like I said, I have heard of people getting stranded on the wrong side of the river on the green, and once it comes up, you can't wade across, so you're going to have to wait for somebody to come get you, I guess. Well, let's talk a little bit about food and flies. Primary food types, what are the primary food types we're going to find in a tailwater?
It really depends upon what part of the tailwater you fish. You know, closest to the dam, it's going to be where you have your heaviest concentration of midges. And then as you move further away from the dam, your aquatic life becomes more diversified. And, so that's really important from a fly selection standpoint. But generally speaking, as a whole, if you carry midges from size 18 down to a 26, you know, larva, pupa, adults, and you carry a bunch of mayfly nymphs, you know, imitating your betas, your pale morning duns, trichos, red quills. I don't know if I mentioned PMDs. I think I did. But and then, obviously, some tailwaters have caddis. Bighorn has caddis. The South Platte has a tremendous amount of caddis now since the Hayman fire. And some stones, you know, yellow sallies, and obviously to have adults of all those. And then, streamers can be important under the right conditions, you know, spring and fall when the fish are spawning.
Okay. Now, we have a question here from Dan in Denver. He wants to know if you've got a particular favorite searching or imitative nymph pattern. You know, I guess the kind of nymph that you use when you don't have a hatch and you don't know what's going on.
That's a great question. I have become a fan of a fly called Pat's Rubber Leg, and it is a stonefly imitation invented by a fellow up in Jackson Hole, Pat Bennett. And that fly is just buggy. It catches fish. Believe it or not, it catches fish at Cheeseman Canyon. So it's a great fly, you know, a big stone, a caddis larva, a leech. That kind of stuff works great. It's going to constitute a kind of a impulse or a opportunistic feeding pattern from a fish.
And that one you had mentioned was Pat's Rubber Leg?
Pat's Rubber Leg, yep. It's a great stonefly imitation. Brown and black has become one of my favorite all-time flies.
Interesting. Okay, and we have another question came in on the Internet. Jerry in Littleton wants to know, how did you develop your top secret midge, and why did you choose rust color for the head? Maybe you should talk about what that is so people know what it is and then answer his question, or at the same time.
Well, the top secret midge came about a few years ago, and it's basically it's a midge pupa, midge emerger. It was invented in first fish on the South Platte, and it's really my go-to small midge. I fish a lot of 24s and 26s, fish 26 today in Cheeseman on my guided trip. It just it really works well when fish are keying in on the really small midges. And it's a kind of a chocolate brown color. It's got a real segmented body like you'd see on a midge. It's got a flashy wing and then a distinct thorax tied out of rust brown dubbing, but it's one of my favorite little patterns. It seems to catch fish, and it's tied on a 2488, so it's got good hookability.
Well, since you mentioned size 26, there's another question on the internet. Alan in Roy, Utah, do you have any tips for landing fish on a size 26? I tend to land a lot less fish after size 18.
You're right on with that. Generally speaking, you know, when you start dropping from a 20 to a 22, you start losing fish. So, you know, I fish a lot of 2488s Temco hook because it's got a wide gape, and I tend to hook more fish and land more fish with that fly or that hook. And also another good tip is to take, for example, you could take a size 20 hook and tie a 22 midge pupa on it, or take a 22 hook and tie a 24 or 26. In other words, just change the proportion on the hook so you have the hookability of a 22, but you're actually tying the proportions of that fly smaller. And that's a great trip that I actually learned on the San Juan River. So those are a couple things that have worked well for me, and hopefully they will for you too.
And you said it was the Tiemco 2488 that you're tying the midges with, right?
Yep, I tie almost all my pupa.
Oh, on that
side. On that hook, you know, it just midge larvas, midge pupas, even some of my small mayfly nymphs, but it's, and there's even a heavy version of that hook, but it's a great hook, great holding power, and again, it's a wide gape hook, so you're going to bring a lot more fish to the net.
Okay, and let's see here. Do you ever fish traditional winged wet flies when you're fishing tailwaters? This is coming from Jim in Jefferson City, Missouri.
I do occasionally fish wet flies, and it can be very, very productive, especially in, that kind of goes back to the question that Dan had about, you know, searching patterns. Sometimes when things are slow, it's not a bad idea to fish a conventional wet fly, or possibly when betas are emerging, or, you know, when caddis are coming off. I think, you know, we just have this thing ingrained in our head that everything has to be dead drifted to catch fish, but the fact of the matter is, wet flies are very, very effective, and I think they have become a lost art for a lot of anglers. And I'm not a huge proponent of wet flies, but I do fish them from time to time, and it's a very, very effective strategy.
Well, I have to plug one of our recent shows because we did a whole show on wet fly fishing with Davey Wanton. And it's a whole nother game, so to speak. And I think what, you know, a lot of people do is they get into their routine and they stick with their routine, but it seems from all the interviews I've done, any routine will work given, you know, you're persistent enough and you're paying attention, it seems. So there's a lot of different methods.
Absolutely. I think you have to have confidence in what you're doing. And And like I said before, I mean, be careful not to outthink yourself. You know, just get something that, you know, flies matching the prevailing conditions and the tactics to, you know, matching the prevailing conditions and fish those flies hard, and you're going to catch fish.
Well, we have Doug Albright in Seattle wants to know if you did mention the one midge that you tie. Are there other midges that you like, particularly on the South Platte there?
I fish, depending upon the time of year, I fish a lot of blood midges, a lot of blood worms, especially during the winter months. One of my favorites is the mercury blood midge. And, you know, in a 20 or a 22, sometimes even an 18, one of my go-to flies on the bighorn. The mercury midge is a good one. I like Charlie Craven's Jujube midge. Typically something with a little bit of flash. I think, you know, that these fish in our tailwaters are hard. They're hard fish. They get, you know, a lot of pressure, and certainly a little dash of flash has always been beneficial. Probably if I had to choose one midge pattern that I, you know, could only fish one midge pattern, it'd either be the Black Beauty or the Top Secret midge.
Well, we have Black Beauty or Top Secret. Okay. And we have a couple. I'm going to try to combine these questions here. Question from Tom Schultz. In Massachusetts, and Steve Bourne, who's Steve from Madison, Wisconsin. Steve was one of our guests on the show. And they're both asking about colors of midge patterns. And specifically, is there a difference between fall and winter? Steve says, like the zebra midge, which advocates blue-colored flies for winter and spring nymphing. Do you have any opinions on the midge people colors?
I traditionally fish dark-colored pupa, lighter-colored larvas, cream larvas, white larvas, red larvas. Red is an incredible color. And as Steve mentioned, blue is, I fish a lot of blue midges, and just with wire or royal blue unithread, silver wire. But blue, fish see blue, especially during low-light conditions. But traditionally, as far as pupa is concerned, darker colors, rust brown, black, works really well for pupas. At least that's what I've found.
Okay. Here's one from Hayden in Sedalia, Colorado. I've heard a few instances when fishing below Cheeseman with a green marabou pattern that is tied to look like moss, that it does really well. Have you tried this? If so, do you know the reason it works? Are trout sucking in moss and getting the nymphs that are stuck in the moss and then spitting it out? What would be your best guess?
I've seen trout move to eat a big chunk of moss, and my guess is they're moving because they think of they're getting a leech. And, you know, those leeches are, you know, you think about a big mass moving down the water. It, you know, the fish are keying on a silhouette more than anything. And if you, you know, you pump fish in Cheeseman Canyon, especially big rainbows, and you do get a lot of moss in those fish, and I think they're taking it potentially for a leech. But, you know, I've sat in the Texas hole on the San Juan River, and I see fish go and grab a clump of moss and then shake it, and then, you know, shake loose those midge larvas, and you'll see other fish come over and eat those larvas as well. So I think they do root around in that moss, and I think, you know, knock some of the bugs loose. But I think they just eat it because they think it's food for the most part.
Okay. We've got a question from Kyle, Hurricane, Utah, wants to know if you, do you ever fish sinking line with bugger-type flies?
I do. More times than not, I fish with a floating line and heavy-weighted flies, conehead buggers or Lawson sculpin, just heavily weighted flies. A lot of times I fish two flies, a tandem rig of streamers, but either heavily weighted flies, or I'll put split shot on the nose of the flies and fish them that way.
And a question from Rick Takahashi, Fort Collins, Colorado. Rick's going to be on our show next, and he's going to be talking about his latest book on midges. So these two shows will go nicely together. He wants to know about how you select what pattern to fish. And you asked about rigging. You kind of talked about that already. But you walk out there on the river, and what's your routine for choosing your flies?
I think, you know, so much of fly fishing is observation. When I got to the canyon this morning, there was an incredible midge hatch. I mean, the sky was just filled with midges, and there was already rising fish, which was incredible. So I had asked my customer to bring two rods, so we set one up for dries, and we had one for nymphs. So, you know, when you see a good midge hatch in progress like that, then obviously you know that there's a lot of pupa in the water column, and those fish will be keyed on pupa. So, you know, you're going to fish either a dry dropper with a pupa pattern on it, or you're going to fish, you know, a conventional nymphing rig, but you're going to keep your strike indicator fairly low to the flies because the fish are going to be, you know, suspended in the water column and a lot less weight. So much of your rig really comes from observation, you know, where they are in the zone. And I know I've talked about that a few times, but, you know, if fish are targeting pupa and you're fishing too much lead, you're fishing below the fish. So, you know, it's not always about, you know, you got to be in the right part of the zone. So there's just so much of micromanaging and having a fairly good idea what the fish are keen on.
Do you think that's a common problem with fly fishers, is not adjusting enough? I mean, not changing the weight level enough to try to find that zone?
I think so. I think, you know, the average guy puts a BB on and he puts a thingamabobber on or even a yarn indicator and he just goes out and he doesn't, you know, make the changes, you know, to get his flies in the correct zone. So I'm constantly, I mean, every riffle, every run, every pocket, I'm either adding weight or taking weight off and, you know, and constantly observing the behavior of the fish. You know, are the fish moving 2-3 inches to eat a pupa, or are they chasing a fly maybe 12 to 16 inches that would potentially indicate that they might be eating something swimming like a betis? So I'm looking for visual clues, you know, around the river as well as, you know, what's going on under the river at all times. And those really help me, you know, unfold my strategy as I go through the day.
Yeah. Time for break. And when we come back, then we'll talk more about strategies and presentations in the tailwaters. At Housatonic River Outfitters, we offer the finest in fly fishing products in Connecticut and fly fishing guides on the Housatonic, Farmington, and other waters. You have the option of wade fishing trips or drifting the river with our guides. In addition to the spectacular trout fishing, we offer guided fly fishing trips and spin fishing guide trips for warm water species. Please tour our website at www.dryflies.com to view the fishing products and guide services we offer in Connecticut, Massachusetts. We were the first fly shop in Connecticut to offer drift boat guide services, and we have the largest established guide service in New England. Learn more about Housatonic River Outfitters. Visit www.dryflies.com. We're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pat Dorsey about fly fishing tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Pat a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, let's talk about strategies and presentation a bit more, because we did get a lot of questions about that. The question, before we actually dive into that, why are people always thinking big fish when they, you know, thinking about tailwaters? Why is that? Is it the nutrient level or the temperature or combination, or what is it?
It's really a combination of everything. And, you know, even though we have hydroelectric fisheries, we have water storage tailwaters, and we have fluctuating flows, it's just amazing, even with all the up and down and changing of flows, that fish can't help but prosper because conditions are so ideal compared to a conventional unregulated stream. So, you know, you've got, you know, the controlled fisheries, certainly the releases aren't nearly as substantial as tailwater or unregulated stream. Temperatures are stable, the nutrient level, the bug life doesn't get scoured out from a conventional runoff. I mean, just all of these things add up, and you traditionally find much higher populations of fish on tailwaters as you do on unregulated streams.
We had a question come in on the Internet from Gary in Olympic, Pennsylvania. Peninsula, I'm sorry again. I think Gary asked a question earlier. Tandem rigs and weight make for difficult casting. What are typical casting distances? And I'm going to add on to his question, do you have any tips for casting tandem rigs?
I traditionally It depends upon, you know, if you're fishing a bigger tailwater where you got to start reaching out and you're fishing mid-channel shells and gravel bars where you got to do a lot of long line nymphing and mending and so on and so forth. You know, Lee's Ferry, they do very long drifts. On my home waters, we do more short line nymphing. So it really depends. On shorter approaches, or I use conventional roll casting, and that's a huge tip because certainly if you get tangled up, then your flies aren't in the water and your success rate goes way down. So you got to keep fishing to be successful. But tandem rigs certainly are more difficult to cast, and probably the biggest tip that I could recommend is just to slow your cast down. You know, just let that line unfold behind you, you know, before you start your forward stroke, because a lot of people, they get in a rush with their cast, and just try to keep your cast as smooth as you can and keep your false cast to a minimum and roll cast, you know, as often as you can, as opposed to false casting with a nymphing rig. Usually false casting is a disaster.
Yeah, yeah. Just once and back and put it in place, or just, like I say, roll it back out. Yeah. Question from Andrew in Franklin, Tennessee. This goes back to tying flies again, but I wanted to kind of pick it up. What are some of your favorite materials for tying midges, both body material, for example, spandex, Spanflex, Crystal Flash, and winging breather material, Antron, et cetera. Do you have any great new and secret materials that you've discovered recently?
You know, most of my flies are fairly simple flies. I just use a lot of thread, a lot of wire, a lot of dubbing. And I think one of the coolest materials that I've come across lately is called Glamour Madura. It's G-L-A-M-O-U-R and then M-A-D-E-R-A. And you have to get it through a craft store. And it's got an interesting prop. It's kind of got some crystal flash, and it's got a little bit of puff like ostrich hurl in it. And that's what I use on my Top Secret midge. But that's a great little wing material for emergers, whether, you know, midge emergers or mayfly emergers. And then other than that, I'm a pretty conventional guy. I all the stuff that you mentioned I use, my crystal flash and just flashaboo. I do use some flexi floss and just some stuff, just foam wings and just a little dash of flash is kind of my cup of tea.
Here's another good question, I think, is Jeff in Littleton, how do you decide when to use a midge larva versus a midge pupa pattern?
That's a great question. And, you know, I fish larvas under the right conditions, but I fish more pupa than I do anything. Certainly, the time to switch to a pupa is when you actually see midge adults on the water, or you see midges flying around. So as soon as a midge hatch becomes evident, then that's when you want to start fishing with your pupas. So first thing in the morning, I might start with a larva, you know, like Bars Pure Midge Larva or a Miracle Nymph for a small buckskin or something like that. And then as I start to see, you know, midges, then I'm going to switch to something like a Black Beauty that has more of a swollen thorax.
Okay, good. Good tips there. Okay, we've got Roy Griffith, Western Pennsylvania. And he says, how do you approach a tailwater that you are fishing for the first time? Do you cover an eastern tailwater the same as in the west? And what different things do you look for? Do you use the same approach regardless of location?
That's a great question. And you know, in theory, a tailwater is a tailwater. And certainly, you know, there is some small differences between tailwaters. But generally, you know, I've spent the vast majority of my time on western waters. But I have some great friends that live in Virginia, and I have some friends that live in South Carolina. So, you know, we get back and fish those tailwaters from time to time. They tend to come out here more. But, you know, I can pretty much take all the flies, the tactics that I use out here in the west and apply them to just about any eastern tailwater, like the Watauga or the South Holston. And so basically probably the biggest key is just to have a lot of mayflies and a lot of midges, as we discussed, you know, 18 through 24, 26. And certainly you do have to have your caddises and your stoneflies and your streamers and so on and so forth. But generally, they fish very, very similar.
What, in answer to his question, part of his question about your approach to a tailwater and what you would do the first time. So say you are walking up to a brand new tailwater and you don't quite never fished there before. What do you start looking for?
You know, it's always a good idea if you can to maybe call a fly shop or get something on the internet if you can. But let's say you have that opportunity. A lot of it is just time of year. So if I was fishing, you know, November through March, it'd be probably pretty safe to assume that I'd be fishing predominantly midges. If it was spring and fall, then I know I'd probably have midges and blue wings probably hatching, midsummer, maybe some pale morning dun. So a seasonal approach is always a good idea. It's just to try to, you know, observe obviously what's going on, but also to kind of strategize on what you think might be hatching. It's always a good idea to seine the water and see what you get. And also maybe take a water temperature. If the water's 36 degrees, you're probably going to find the fish, you know, in the deeper, slower water. If it's, you know, 42, 44, 46, you'll probably start to find some fish in the riffles. So there's so much going on that it's really a big problem-solving exercise. But the beautiful thing is the longer you fish, the more comfortable that you're going to be, and you're just going to be able to dissect any number of tailwaters. Just being able to, you know, apply the knowledge that you've learned from another tailwater, time of year, water temperature, hatches, and all the things that we addressed.
I think what you said about the seasonal differences, I think that makes a big difference. And if nothing else, if you can get a hatch chart for the area, then you'll know what should be there, even if it's not hatching at the moment, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's always safe, I think, in my opinion, to fish one midge and one mayfly. You will catch fish in almost every scenario, let's just under normal conditions, you know, not raging flows, so on and so forth. But if you got one midge, one mayfly, you've got your bases covered in most cases.
Here's an interesting question off the internet. Bob in Longmont, Colorado. I fished the Blue, and he's talking about the Blue River in Colorado, yesterday and found, which is a tailwater, fish rising, leaping out of the water, but saw absolutely no insects anywhere. What do you suppose they were feeding on?
That's a great question. In fact, I did a guide trip on the Blue yesterday, and there was a lot of rising fish to midges and to blue wings. And I fished in town. I'm not sure where Bob fished, but what Bob's seeing is he's seeing brown trout that are spawning, and they're jumping out of the air. They're trying to soften up their eggs so they can spawn. So if you just see those fish that are shooting out, I presume it was a brown, it's part of the spawning process that takes place. You see it on the tailor, you see it on the frying pan, anywhere that there's heavy concentrations of fish. So, you know, and your first instinct would be to think that they're maybe taking a caddis or something of that nature. But if it was a brown trout, that was what was going on. But there was a lot of midge and a lot of mayfly activity in the town of Silverthorne yesterday. Was really fishing pretty good.
Right in town, right?
Right in town. I was amazed. Got to the shop this morning, and I was telling Jimmy, I said, you need to get up there. Fishing was pretty dang good.
Well, we broadcast our show all over the world, so the people that aren't familiar with this water, folks, this is a place where they have these factory outlet stores. It's like a shopping mall with the Blue River running right through it. And for those men that whose wives don't fish, it's a great place that you can just take your wife and set her off shopping, and then you can have some trophy fishing right next to the store. It's a pretty odd situation, isn't it, Bev?
It is. It's. I only had a half day yesterday, so you know, it was the perfect call. But yeah, you got this world class tailwater flowing right through urban trout. You know, it's. In fact, the people that we got it yesterday were really blown away with how productive it was and where it was.
yeah, very interesting. And you know, a lot of those fish are pretty intelligent, too, from a standpoint of they're not easy to catch in there, are they, Pat?
They're not easy. Most of these fish, you know, they're pressured pretty hard, and, you know, it's clear water, and the Blue is one of those places where you really have to know what you're doing to do well in there. And it's a great fishery, but that one can beat you up.
Yeah, yeah. Brookie in Oklahoma asks, I'd like to hear Pat's thoughts on sight nymphing without an indicator or with a very minimal indicator. Is this an approach he uses? If so, where and when? Any suggestions on the best rig for this?
I'd sight nymph whenever possible, and I think that's probably one of the biggest strategies becoming very successful as an angler is, you know, keeping your flies in front of fish. And I think, you know, most guides, that's their approach as well, as opposed to blind fishing water. So your odds go down dramatically by by blind fishing. So certainly training your eye to see fish, looking in the right water to begin with is all important. And then even with an indicator, whatever you opt to use, no indicator if you're just tight lining or if you're using yarn or the little teeny thingamabobber or a foam indicator. You know, I key on my indicator considerably less than I do. I key on the fish, and I'm looking for fish to lift in the water column, you know, move 3-4 inches to the right or to the left. And in a lot of cases, I just look for the white of their mouth. You know, the fish is dark, and when they open their mouth, it looks like a little ping pong ball down there. So you actually see the fish feed by the mouth. So I traditionally use a yarn indicator most of the time, unless I fish the tail or the frying pan, and then there's times where those fish are very leader and very strike indicator sensitive, so I'll take it off completely. But I do a combination of both. I watch the fish a lot, and I think that's extremely important in your sight nymphing applications.
Okay. Well, Pat, we need to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about strategies and presentation. Platte River Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming features a first-class website covering all aspects of fly fishing the tailwaters of the North Platte River, including up-to-date local fishing reports, fly patterns, guide services, and online shopping for top-of-the-line gear for any travel destination. Platte River Fly Shop provides a professional guide staff for the Blue Ribbon, Trophy, Gray Reef, and Miracle Mile sections of the North Platte River. Visit their extensive website at www.wyotrout.com. That's WYOTrout.com, or call them at 307-237-5997. That's 307-237-5997. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Pat Dorsey about fly fishing tailwaters. If you'd like to ask Pat a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. Well, we've still got lots of questions to go here, Pat, so let's see what kind of damage we can do here. Ron Alton in Evergreen, Colorado wants to know, is it better to fish a tailwater closer to the dam or farther downstream?
I think generally always you're better off fishing it. The closer to the dam, the better, I think, you know, because it's just more predictable, more reliable, the water's clear, and in most cases the conditions are considerably more ideal closer to the dam.
Okay, and let's see here. John in Baltimore asks, what is your approach to targeting the big tailwater trout? Do you fish larger flies and certain types for the large fish? Do you select any particular kind, potential holding area, depth, current, or time of day? You need to be more stealth and patient.
I think, you know, big fish as a whole, I mean, certainly you do have to be stealthy, you know, and you know, the big fish are going to certainly hold in different water than smaller fish. You know, your smaller fish are going to traditionally hold in the riffles and the transitional zones, but your bigger fish are going to, they're going to sit under logs or undercut banks and so on and so forth. And, you know, probably the best time to catch trout is when they migrate to spawn. So they start to come out of their traditional hiding spots and they're migrating, whether they're coming out of reservoirs or they're coming out of their traditional spots, their hiding lies. That's when you can target some of these bigger fish. But certainly your brown trout, I think you catch your bigger browns during low light conditions, and you're going to catch, you know, your bigger browns on mice patterns and streamers. And you catch some nice rainbows on streamers as well. So I've never been a big advocate of night fishing, although one of my colleagues at the shop, Cody Scott, he's a huge night fisherman, and he does well at night. So to each their own on that too.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things, too, is just locating those big fish in the first place, right?
I mean, absolutely. If people that live in the West, they know about the Dream Stream and the big fish that migrate out of 11-mile reservoir into the South Platte. So, yeah, you got to be able to sight nymph. And, you know, just having a keen eye is what it's all about. And then big trout are opportunistic, so they have to eat a lot. And, you know, so big streamers, dead drifted and stripped. It's just big fish are opportunistic, and you got to find them. And generally, if you can find those big fish, you can get them to eat.
Yeah, and I think that's, I know when one of our guests, Landon Mayer, who's kind of specializes in big fish, was talking about spending hours just walking the river just looking for that fish because he wanted to catch a big fish. And, you know, the people that catch the big ones put in a lot of time to catch those big fish.
Well, they do. And Landon's certainly he's the guru on catching big fish. And, you know, he'll walk 5, 6, 7 miles in a day to try to find the fish.
And he's got that beautiful picture.
Yeah. That's right.
That's only part one of catching that fish, right?
That's right.
We got a long way to go before we get to that pretty picture, that's for sure. Well, here's an interesting question. Silas Gray in Missouri. Hey, Pat, what do you suggest when there is zero flow so you can't drift a fly and the water is so clear that streamers are spooking the fish?
I don't get into situations where there's very little flow very often. Most of the tailwaters that I fish, minimum flow is 50 cubic feet per second. But that, you know, when the flows get low, then the fish are very, very spooky. So that's a good time to fish dry dropper rigs and, you know, try to just be real stealthy, real careful with your apparel selection. You want to wear drab colored clothing, and you have to be super stealthy, and your cast has to be light, and you have to try to find some water with a little bit of current to it. And I'm not sure what he means by zero flow. Probably a river that's not generating at all. It can be tough. I mean, if you're fishing dries, you got to fish long leaders, 7X tippet, small flies, and it's just a whole different game when the flows are low like that.
Yeah, he's almost sounding like some kind of slow spring creek or something that he's describing there. And I suppose there are places like that or even backwaters. Like down on the San Juan, you can get some of that water, you know, out around the sides of the islands there where there's not much flow. But we got a question from Rod Shears in Amarillo. When you see a large pod of fish together, what is the best approach to catch the majority of these fish?
Well, you know, a lot of it depends upon, you know, whether or not they're feeding or not. And that kind of revolves back around to the last question, too. Certainly, you know, being able to identify feeding fish is one of the most critical aspects of being successful in fly fishing. So if you got a pod of fish and if they're feeding, I've always found that if they're feeding aggressively, then they're considerably harder to spook, and that's the optimum conditions. If you got a bunch of fish that are, you know, sipping spent wing mayflies down or blue wing olives, then, you know, you can be not careless, but certainly you don't have to be quite as crafty to catch those fish. But if I do have a pod of fish and I hook one, then I try to get that fish out of that pod, you know, move downstream or get him out and try not to disrupt the rest of the pod, so to speak. So generally speaking, you know, when you have a pod, your first few drifts are going to be your best opportunity to catch those fish. And I think as you continue to fish to that pod, then your odds drop dramatically of catching further fish.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting, some of your home waters up there over by Decker's, when they were doing the fly fishing championship, I was standing up on the bridge there just looking down into the river there. And it was fun from that perspective to see some trout down there that were holding in the edge of a current and watching their feeding patterns. And it was real educational, you know, to watch them just come out, grab something out of the current, then come back in and then sit there. Come out, grab something, and there was like three of them all kind of working that. And it taught me something because you don't see that as well when you're down at river level, to see their movement and how they move around. And that kind of taught me something about how to fish that type of area, too. So I think what you're saying about observation is key.
No, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, watching a fish feed is, I think, one of the most valuable lessons you'll get on a trout stream. And they're super proficient with the way they feed, and you can learn a lot about it, and they don't make many mistakes.
We've got a couple other questions here. Chuck Kaminsky in Oklahoma wants to know, the tailwaters in Colorado, Montana, et cetera, have the same problems with dissolved oxygen levels that we have to deal with here in South Central region, Missouri, Arkansas. Do you know anything about the oxygen levels that he's talking about?
I could not answer that question. I'm sorry.
Okay, no problem. Another one here, Dennis, Helena, Montana, says, any idea of how to handle weeds and grass like on the Missouri when trying to nymph? So,
yeah, certainly it's a problem whether you're fishing the South Platte or you're fishing the Bighorn or the Missouri early in the season, you know, your weed growth is at a minimum, but as the season progresses, then you start to get more and more foliage underneath, and nymphing really becomes problematic at that point. So the best way to get around that is a dry dropper rig. I mean, that's really the only way to get around when you get that type of weed growth.
Dry dropper?
Dry droppers.
Dry fly, like, are you talking about like a tractor pattern or actually a, you know, like a dry mayfly or something?
Yeah, you could do a lot of things. You could fish a Griffith gnat or a big bushy midge adult and then drop a, a dropper, maybe a tungsten or something like a zebra midge or something like that. Off that works good. Or you could fish a big attractor like Amy's Ant and even do a double dropper. So there's a lot of different ways, depending upon how thick the moss is there, the weed growth, would determine, you know, your length of your dropper and how heavy your dropper. I mean, when I fish droppers, I generally have standard gold bead droppers, and I have tungsten droppers of a variety of sizes, and so you really, there's a lot of fine-tuning your droppers, too, with different beads and such.
Well, it sounds like you're favorable towards beads. Is that something you use a lot, all the time? How do you decide when to use a beaded fly over a non-beaded version?
I use a lot of beads, bead heads, almost all of my fly, but a lot of my midge patterns have beads, whether they're glass beads, and I'm using more and more little tungsten beads. But certainly the speed of the current, you know, has a ramification on that. You know, I mean, the depth of the current, the zone of the fish. So that's why I carry various patterns. But I think, you know, for conventional dry dropper fishing, I fish a lot of just standard gold bead pheasant. That works good and a variety of sizes and imitates a lot of different food organisms.
Yeah, that pheasant tail is a good go-to fly, isn't it?
Oh, it's a great fly. You can't go wrong with it.
Yeah, yeah. I got a lot of the questions I have left. I've kind of been pushing them off to the side here, both online and offline, because they're more locale-specific. And a lot of people are listening. It must be from Colorado and know where you fish. They might be outside your house right now, Pat, waiting for you to leave tomorrow to follow you around. But anyway, so I'm going to run some of these kind of local questions by you. First one is Fred in Colorado Springs wants to know, are there a lot of browns at Spinny Mountain at the moment? Seeing any browns up there moving up into the river now?
That run was, I think, a little disappointing this year. Obviously, the flows were the biggest problem up there this year. We didn't see as many fish up there. And the fish that are being caught now are in the deeper holes and on streamers. Now, certainly, you can find browns up there, but there's a lot of people targeting those fish on reds, unfortunately. So you got to really be careful with that. So if those fish are in shallow riffles, they're spawning around the railroad trestle there. Up in the upper parking lot, there is some fish, but the migrating fish, the fish that we want to target, those fish, they're just, the numbers are way down this year, and a lot of it's revolved around the flow, because the flow's been between 70 and 90 this year, and it's considerably higher this time of year.
You're talking about the Dream Stream section?
The Dream Stream, yeah.
Yeah. Mike Schwartz is asking about that, too, so you can answer his question. Another, let's see, Ralph Parker. Ralph in Parker, Colorado. What is the most productive color and size for shrimp or scuds at Cheeseman and at Silverthorne? Blue River, I guess he's talking.
I fish on the blue, I fish the Mysa shrimp, generally an 18 or a 20. And I like Laney's Mysis or Will Sands Mysis. Those are my two favorite Mysis patterns. And they can be very effective as an attractor a large percentage of the year. Cheeseman, there's been a lot of really good things going on at Cheeseman. It's fishing better than it has in over a decade, and certainly there's been a lot of problems with the Hayman fire. The scud population and the aquatic worm population took a substantial hit with all the decomposed granite that has been coming down the canyon. And so the scud populations aren't like the good old days, but the fact of the matter is the canyon is, the substrate is really starting to stabilize, the substrate's getting dark again, we're getting a tremendous amount of weed growth in there again, so What that means is the decomposed granite, for the most part, has started to, it's tapered off dramatically. So I suspect that we're going to start to see the scud population and worm populations come back strong. And when that does, size, 14s and 16s have always been my favorite scuds, particularly orange and Cheeseman.
Yeah, okay, good. All right, let's see here. Mike in Evergreen, Colorado, I found that it's taking smaller and smaller flies, as you mentioned before, to catch fish on the plat. Why is that?
I think, Mike,
true.
It is true, and you see it even on the San Juan. I mean, those guides are fishing a lot more 26s now down there. And I'm finding myself fishing smaller and smaller and smaller. And I think it's just because our fish are getting more pressure. And, there's really not a lot of room for mistakes. But you can fool a lot of fish on a 26. A 26 Parachute Adams is my go-to fly. I mean, that fished well during the mid-chatch today. So, if you fish that with frogs, Fanny, you can see that fly relatively easy. A 26 Adams is good on any tailwater where there's midges. And, your small pupas, again, time on 24/88s, 24s, 26s, you'll be fine. You'll catch plenty of fish. You'll catch more fish. And certainly you're going to land less fish, but, all we can ask is you're getting some action and you get an opportunity to try to land those fish, and you're going to get considerably more strikes fishing smaller flies.
It's hard to believe they go after those little teeny things and somehow make a meal of that, huh? They do. And it's funny when you get a 22, 24-inch trout and bring it in and find you caught it on a 22 midge. It's pretty incredible, I think.
No, it's a kick.
Yeah, it always amazes me. Brian in Greenville, South Carolina asks, have you ever tried your top secret midge in South Carolina waters? And I guess more importantly, do you use this with a dropper fly? And if so, what? Can you kind of describe more about how you fish that secret midge?
I generally fish the top secret, whether I'm fishing a tailwater, in his neck of the woods, which I'm going to fish his neck of the woods in February. I'm down there doing the big expo in South Carolina. And I typically fish the top secret midge, whether I'm east or western waters, with less weight than I do a dredging approach, just because it's more of a pupa. So, long indicator generally, or excuse me, short indicator, and just, keeping that dialed in, like probably a number four split shot in most cases would work good on that.
Great, great. Now, is that top secret midge pattern in your book?
It is in my book. I think a lot of flies, it's actually in my South Platte book, and it's in my tailwater book, but it's kind of got a unique name to it, but it's a great little fly, and it's a simple little fly, as most of my patterns are.
Well, top secret, that makes you want to know about it,
That's right.
It's a good marketing decision to name that top secret, Okay, well, that we've run out of time, but covered a lot of grounds. I think we answered most of the questions that were out there, but we got to wrap things up. And when we return, we'll be giving away a 3-year membership to the Federation of Fly Fishers, a 1-year subscription to Fly Fusion magazine. And thanks to Pat Stackpole Books, we'll be giving away a copy of Pat's latest book, Fly Fishing Tailwaters. So stay tuned to see if you win. Bristol Bay region of southwest Alaska is home to the largest runs of wild salmon on the planet and some of the best trophy rainbow trout fishing found anywhere. The Pebble Mine still remains a threat to the region, and 2 million acres of federal lands may also be at risk. The entire fly fishing industry has united in this epic conservation battle. Anglers from across the country are joining the fight. Be one of them. Visit www.savebristolbay.org. That's www.savebristolbay.org, and you can learn more about this challenge and how you can get involved. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find the link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show, and it says, what do you think of this show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. And the winners of our drawings are randomly selected from our database. And to get on the database, you had to have filled out the registration form in advance. Now it's a little too late, but make sure you do it next time because we're always giving away some great prizes. Well, let me see here. So we're going to do this random selection first for the three-year membership for the Federation of Fly Fishers. And our winner there is Ronnie Malatesta. Ronnie Malatesta. And Ronnie is in Mississippi. So congratulations, and you'll get that three-year membership to the Federation. If you'd like to find out more about the Federation of Fly Fishers, go to fedflyfishers.org. Fedflyfishers.org, a great organization to support. Okay, now, second winner for one-year subscription to Fly Fusion Magazine. And Fly Fusion Magazine is a magazine out of Calgary, Canada. Great magazine, beautifully done, and super high quality. And our winner there is John Moran. John Moran in Missouri. So, John, congratulations, too, on winning that one-year subscription. Well, now, Pat, we got to give away your book.
All right.
Here after tonight, some people are going to be very anxious to get their wet paws on that book. So, okay. Now, what they think I'm going to ask here, Pat, is they think I'm going to ask, what's the name of that hot fly that you keep talking about? But guess what? I'm not going to ask that. So let's see if how many people have already answered. Nope, they haven't. Oh, they're getting smart nowadays. Okay, Pat talked about a hook that he ties almost all of his midges and nymph patterns on, and that is what kind of fly and what's the number on it? This is a tough one, Pat, but they had to be listening closely.
Right.
Too bad you can't give me multiple answers in one message. That's not fair. That's doing the ultimate guess routine. So here we go. I've got an answer that says TMC 2488. Would that be the right answer?
That's correct.
Well, that's Phil Panko in Kaysen, Minnesota. So, Phil, you just won yourself Fly Fishing Tailwaters by Pat Dorsey. So congratulations, congratulations. And Phil has been listening to our show since day one, I think. So I know the name, and I'm glad he won. So anyway, Phil, I've got your email. Send me your address and so forth so that we can get Stackpole to send out that book. And I know he's going to enjoy it, and hopefully he'll catch more fish after reading it. Right, Pat?
Yes, sir. Thank you for reading it.
Yeah, yeah. And be sure to tell others about it once you get it. It's a beautiful book. Okay. Well, that's it for the prizes, and I do want to thank Stackpole Books. They provide a lot of great books for us to give away on our shows, and we surely do appreciate it. Pat, and we surely appreciate you being on the show again. It was nice to have you. And we got to look forward to that fly tying book you're coming out with. I think that'll be another nice addition to our library. So thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it's been great, and I'm sure you're tired and ready to call it a night. And we'll hopefully talk again. Our next broadcast will be on November 25th. We're skipping a couple weeks here. And it's going to be at 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern. That show will be interviewing Rick Takahashi, and our topic for the show will be midge secrets, a good follow-up to our tailwater talk tonight. Rick considers midges the most important year-round food source for trout, and they are almost in every stream and lake around the world. So listen in to learn about tying and fishing midges that will work no matter where you live. We'd like to thank the Federation of Fly Fishers, Fly Fusion Magazine, Platte River Fly Shop, Front Range Anglers, and the Housatonic River Outfitters for sponsoring our show tonight. If you think your company would benefit from sponsoring one of our shows, give us a call at 1-888-961-1115, extension 2. That's 1-888-961-1115, extension 2, and we'll be happy to explain the options to you. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.